Morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you this morning to Grace Life Bible Church live stream for our adult Sunday school class from This Generation Forever. Looks like we got about three people tuning in right at this juncture. We're glad that you have chosen to join us for this class. I'm still trying to figure out why I cannot get my Mevu camera to stream to Facebook and YouTube at the same time. When I try to do that, I get an internet error saying that I'm not connected to the internet, and then when I switch off and go straight to YouTube without changing anything else, I get a completely, it goes straight on, live stream works fine. I'm kind of baffled and not really sure what's going on. I've asked some questions in the Mevu community on Facebook about it. If anyone has any suggestions or knows about these cameras, if you could let me know, I'd appreciate it. Anyway, this morning, you'll find the link to today's notes in the comments under the live video. It says, here's a link to today's notes, and then you can click that and you can load them. So I also made a comment there in the live stream chat directing people to that, and I'm also going to paste right now, if I can, the link also into the live chat. So if somebody comes along after this, once I get rolling, and asks where they can find the notes, those of you that are tuned in and aware of where to find them, if you could answer that question for them in the live chat, I would appreciate that. Anyway, you should have in front of you a set of notes for Lesson 115, the Coverdale Bible, Assessing Coverdale's Ability as a Translator. So this is Lesson 115, the Coverdale Bible, Assessing Coverdale's Ability as a Translator. So like we've done the last two times, I'm just going to go through these. Hopefully you'll have availability there where you can follow along with me as we work our way through this material this morning. So I'm going to get right in then to the introduction. Last week in Lesson 114, we sought to assess the sources of Coverdale's Bible. In doing so, we observed that Coverdale was not proficient in the source languages of Hebrew and Greek, and therefore had to rely on Latin and German sources. So I went through a lot of time last time in Lesson 114 establishing that. We looked at the documentary evidence from the first edition that was printed in Antwerp that said on the title page that it was translated out of German and Latin. Then we went through a whole bunch of information about the parallel editions that Coverdale had printed and other things in Lesson 114 that I don't want to get into and reteach here this morning, because if I do that, we won't make any progress. But that's an important lesson on the assessing the source of the translation that we went through last time. Next point. In terms of the publication and reception of Coverdale's Bible by the people of England, a topic that I haven't touched on yet, so we haven't really talked about how the populace of England received Coverdale's Bible, okay? Blackford Condit makes the following statement in his The History of the English Bible from 1882. He says, quote, "For 10 years, the people had been familiar with Tyndale's printed New Testament, and for some 5 or 6 years with parts of the Old Testament of Tyndale's translation. And now, from the hand of Coverdale, they received the whole Bible in print." So this is the first time that the people of England have had access to the whole Bible in English, in a printed form. Wycliffe had it in a handwritten form and manuscript form. Coverdale is the first one to put it or make it available, the entire thing from Genesis to Revelation, in printed form. Tyndale did not finish the project before he died, as we've well established. That it was favorable, so we're talking about Coverdale, that it was favorably received by the people, we have strong evidence, in fact, that the first edition was exhausted during the year 1536. So by the time the edition is printed, makes it over, is bound by Nicholson in England, and is available to be sold in England in 1536, it basically sells out of the first edition in the first year. And that in 1537, so the next year, 1537, two editions, one in folio, the other in quattro. So that's just talking about the size of the Bible, okay? The dimensions of it, the size of it, how big and small the dimensions of the Bible are, were published by James Nicholson of Southwark. Besides, there was another issue of Coverdale's Bible in 1550, which was reprinted in 1553. The last that I can verify that a Coverdale Bible was reprinted or reissued is in the year 1553. So its reception initially is quite significant, probably because it's the first opportunity for the English people to have the entire Bible in their language. So what we want to do today then in Lesson 115, our primary goal is going to be to assess Coverdale's skill and ability as a translator. This is an important point that we have to consider to some degree, because we know that certain sections of the Bible had been made available previously by Tyndale, but then there are other sections that were wholly undone or untranslated that Coverdale is going to be largely responsible for, and that's kind of what we want to look at today. We want to look at his ability as a translator. So underneath that point, let's look at the first bullet. In his The Making of the English Bible, Gerald Hammond cites C.S. Lewis, or credits C.S. Lewis, with having made the definitive statement regarding the Coverdale Bible. So C.S. Lewis makes some interesting comments about Coverdale and his ability and his strengths and weaknesses as a translator, and Hammond quotes them in his book from 1983. This is the quote. The definitive statement about his Bible was made by C.S. Lewis as a scholar, quote, he was like a rowing boat among battleships, but as a creative artist, he is the translator whose choice of rendering came nearest to being determined by taste. So as a translator, he is dwarfed by Tyndale in his ability to handle Hebrew and Greek. He's not proficient in those languages. So as a translator, because of that, he's going to be translating by taste. In other words, how things sound. He's making judgment calls based upon English and how things sound in English more so than he is to a strict understanding of the syntax and word order of the Hebrew and Greek manuscripts that were available for translation. What Lewis means is that because Coverdale did not know Hebrew or Greek, he was forced to choose between versions of other translators, and that in the process, he was largely guided by his own aesthetic judgment. So we've already covered this, right? He says in the preface, in his dedication to the king and his translator to the reader there in the 1535 edition, he talks about the five sundry translators that he used to make his translation. So what he's doing is he's judging between these five sundry editions based upon aesthetic judgment and taste for how things will sound in English. And luckily for Coverdale, finishing the quote, and this fortunately was more than sound, Coverdale has skill in English that he lacks with the original languages. So he can look at Latin and German, which he has a much better understanding of than Hebrew and Greek, and he can make some pretty good aesthetic judgments about how to state things in English based upon his understanding of German and Latin as opposed to Hebrew and Greek. So moving on to the next point. Donald L. Brake, author of A Visual History of the English Bible, offers the following analysis of Coverdale's skill as a translator. He says, quote, Coverdale only slightly revised Tyndale's translation of the New Testament and the Pentateuch, Jonah, and the historical books. And I have a bracket there in that quote. Daniel proved that Tyndale's version of Joshua through Chronicles was not put in print until the Matthew's Bible of 1537. So I don't agree with Brake there. I'm siding with Daniel on this point of scholarship here, that Coverdale did not use the historical books of Joshua through 2 Chronicles that Tyndale had previously done. Tyndale's work on those books does not show up in print until the Matthew's Bible of 1537, which is going to be the next Bible we talk about when we're done looking at Coverdale. His original and most creative translation came in his work of the poetic and prophetic books. That's a theme we're going to be looking at throughout the most of this lesson. If you want to judge the skill of Tyndale as an original translator, that is, judging him not through the filter of Tyndale, but on his own merit as a translator, you primarily are going to want to look at the poetic books and the prophetic books to be able to do that. Without Tyndale to follow, he was left to his own stylistic contributions. He emphasized the readability of the receptor language rather than the source language, in which he clearly was not competent. His translation of the Psalms became the standard for the Psalter for years to come, and was used in the Common Book of Prayer from 1549 through 1560. Now, Sylvia, if you're watching this, we need to check that date. I think that 1560 date is wrong. I think that should say 1860, if not 1960. So please note that if you're listening. The bottom line is, Coverdale's work on the Psalms becomes the standard text of the Common Book of Prayer. That's a statement, at least to his ability, as far as how he handled the Psalms. Now, we'll look at a lot more detail about that here shortly. According to Brake, Coverdale did not capture much of the Hebrew structure, such as parallelism and rhythmic cadence. He then provides the following examples and commentary. So he's going to give two examples. He's going to give the first example here in the notes is from Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 2. So let's look at Tyndale. Here's how Tyndale said that in those two verses. He said, And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took a daughter of Levi, and the wife conceived and bare a son. And when she saw that it was a proper child, she hid him 3 months long. Coverdale says, And there went forth a man of the house of Levi, and took a daughter of Levi, and the wife conceived and bare a son, and when it was a proper child, she hid him 3 months. So in this example of Exodus 2, Tyndale's work is available as a base for Coverdale to work off of. So you can see in this example that Coverdale does not change very much of what Tyndale had done before him in this regard. And then thirdly, we have the King James reading on these two verses from Exodus. It says in the King James, And there went a man of the house of Levi and took a wife of the daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. So you can see that the King James is a further sort of clarification, refinement, if you want to say it that way, on Tyndale and Coverdale. But the point here is that where Tyndale is available, Coverdale just sort of refined him slightly. Then we got another example from Brake of Psalm 1:1. So I have this in the notes, Psalm 1:1. So this is an example of where Tyndale had not previously translated, so Coverdale is on his own to follow the five sundry interpreters that he's using to make this translation. So if you look at the notes there, here's what Coverdale said in this verse. O blessed is ye man, it goeth not in the counsel of ye ungodly, it abideth not in the way of sinners, it sitteth not ye seat of the scornful. So that's what Coverdale had in Psalm 1:1. The King James reads, Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. So you can see how the King James is much more smooth, much more rhythmic than what Coverdale had done originally in Psalm 1:1. So remember, Psalm 1:1, Tyndale hasn't translated that. There's nothing available for him to work off of as far as a printed edition of the English Bible at that point. So Coverdale's work there is somewhat original to himself. So underneath the quotes there, it seems fairly clear that Coverdale slightly revised Tyndale in Exodus 2, and the King James follows both closely, whereas Coverdale's Psalm 1 and the King James vary slightly. This pattern can be observed by simple comparison. Coverdale felt the freedom to emphasize style and English composition more than accuracy based upon the original text. So from that, if you look at the next bullet, we can kind of, I think, gather some important conclusions or observations. If the analysis of Brake, Hammond, and Lewis is correct, there are two categories then that we need to consider Coverdale's ability as a translator. The first category would truly be Coverdale as a translator, as an original translator. And his ability to translate originally, when I say originally, I mean original work to himself. Not, in the next point, Coverdale as a reviser. So there's two things there that we need to consider with Coverdale if we're going to be accurate and analyze his work. The first is his skill as an original translator, and then the second would be his skill as a reviser as far as reworking Tyndale. So the focus of this lesson then is going to be the first of those 2 points, and we're going to be talking about Coverdale as a translator throughout the rest of our time. And I'm going to switch over, see if there's any questions or comments. Doesn't seem to be at this point. Hopefully everybody is able to locate those notes. So I'm going to get right in then to the next point, which is Coverdale as a translator, poetry, and prophecy. Knowing that Tyndale was not able to finish the Pentateuch, Knowing that Tyndale was only able to finish the Pentateuch, historical books, Joshua through 2 Chronicles, Jonah, and the New Testament before he was martyred, it is to the poetic and prophetic books that we must turn to ascertain Coverdale's impact as a translator. After noting Tyndale's prior work, Hammond writes the following about Coverdale. He says, quote, "This leaves the prophetic and poetic books of the Old Testament, and it is to these books that we see Coverdale's creative translation at its freest, unaffected by an existing English version." So that's what I'm getting at here. It's in these books, the poetic books, the wisdom literature, and the prophets, that we see Coverdale's ability to stand alone as a translator without building or revising Tyndale, who had done work before him. S.L. Greenslade, author of the essay, English Version of the Bible, I think that should say English Versions of the Bible, 1525 to 1611 from the Cambridge History of the Bible, concurs with Hammond and Brake that Coverdale's English style is best judged from his work on the Psalms. Greenslade says, quote, "His English style is commonly judged by his Psalms, where it is at its best, abounding in music, beautifully phrased. Elsewhere, he is generally smoother and more melodious than Tyndale, less given to variation, missing sometimes of his swiftness and native force, but often finding a better phrase. His style tends to adapt itself to the interpreter most in use." So that means the style of Coverdale is going to depend on, is he using the Vulgate? Is he using Luther's German? Is he using Zwingli? Which one of the five interpreters is he using when he's translating a given passage? That's what Greenslade is saying here. Hence, his coining of Germanic compounds, dead barrier, hand reaching, righteousness making, and the like. So we see these German structures, linguistic structures, that work their way into Coverdale, which are a dead giveaway of those instances where he is following the German. And so that's something that we just sort of need to consider. Condens, the History of the English Bible from 1882, states the following regarding the enduring impact of Coverdale's work on the Psalms. Quote, "The English church to this day reads in her prayer book Coverdale's version of the Psalms with very few changes, and even these are for the most part verbal, so that essentially the version of 1535 is retained. The History of the English Bible from 1882, not only the English Book of Prayer, but our present version of the Psalms is indebted to Coverdale for its rhythmic flow and strength of expression." So the most enduring portion of Coverdale's work is the Psalms. His version of the Psalms make it into the Common Book of Prayer and are used by the Anglican Church for centuries during their worship service. So that's an important thing to consider as you sort of try to wrestle with to understand how Coverdale is doing his work. In order to ascertain the truthfulness of Condon's statement, please consider the following table presenting Psalms 2 from Coverdale and the King James Bible in parallel columns. Please note the words found in Coverdale, but not in the King James, have been underlined. Likewise, working changes made by the King James translators have been bolded. So what I try to do there in this table is I try to show you for a longer passage here how Coverdale did the Psalms versus how the King James translators did the Psalms. So what I'm going to suggest is that we look at a few of these. I don't think we need to necessarily read every single one of these, but let's make some comparisons here between how Coverdale handled Psalm 2 versus the King James translators and how they handled Psalm 2. So look at there. So if you're following along, you're just joining me, I'm at the bottom of page 3 at the table comparing Coverdale and King James for Psalm 2. So let's look at verse 1. Cloverdale said, why do the heathen grudge? Why do the people imagine vain things? King James says, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? So you have some changes there, right? Grudge is changed to rage, and vain things, plural, is rendered singular, a vain thing. So there's some differences there between Cloverdale and King James in verse 1. Let's look at verse 2, Cloverdale. The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers are come together against the Lord and against his anointed. King James in verse 2. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying. So when I read them out loud, it's the King James reading is definitely much smoother. It's definitely much more fluid in the way that it's reading. Let's look at verse 3. Verse 3 in Cloverdale, let us break their bonds asunder and cast away their yoke from us. King James, let us break their bonds, or let us break their bands, is a change I missed there. Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. So there's two wording differences between them. Bonds in Cloverdale becomes bands in King James, and yoke in Cloverdale becomes cords in King James. And the reading is just a little bit more fluid. Let's look at verse 4. Nevertheless, Cloverdale here, nevertheless, he that dwelleth in heaven shall laugh them to scorn, yea, even the Lord himself shall have them in derision. King James for verse 4. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. So again, there's some differences there in wording between Cloverdale and King James. But I'll say this. You can see the basic structure of King James in Cloverdale in this example here, right? So this is an example again where Cloverdale is not able to work off Tyndale as a base. He is wholly reliant on his own ability and his own judgments from the five sundry interpreters that he's using. But his work here is establishing a base in English for the Psalms. Let's look at one more example, verse 5. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Now go to the King James. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Exactly the same. The King James has made no change. Verse 6, from Cloverdale. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Verse 6 in the King James, yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Only difference is how Zion is spelled. All right. So you can go through there, the rest of this table, all the way down there through the end of verse 12, and you can see and make the comparisons yourself. So let's look at the point in between the two tables there on page 4. As one can see, little has changed in the King James from how Coverdale's Bible read in 1535. Let's also consider the popular 23rd Psalm as another example. This is a popular psalm. So Cloverdale in verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, I can want nothing. King James, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Again, more smooth. But the base of the King James is laid down in Cloverdale. Verse 2, he feedeth me in green pastures and leadeth me to fresh water. That was Cloverdale. King James, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures and he leadeth me beside the still waters. Verse 3, he quickeneth my soul, this is Cloverdale, he quickeneth my soul and bringeth me forth in the way of righteousness for his name's sake. King James, he restoreth my soul, he leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. So again, some differences in wording, but essentially following the same structure. King James is following the structure of Cloverdale. Verse 4. Though I should walk now in the valley of the shadow of death, yet I fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy staff and thy sheep hook, that's what he means, comfort me. King James, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff comfort me. So those of us that are familiar with the 23rd Psalm from the King James Bible, when I read it from Coverdale, you can kind of see the similar structure, but you also encounter words that are older that you're not used to hearing. Okay, but the structure is similar. Verse 5, Thou preparest a table before me against mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil and fillest my cup full. King James, Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. The difference there between the syntax and the way it reads is important. Something else is occurring to me here as I'm teaching this. If you look there at verse 5, notice that it says, Thou preparest a table. Notice the EST, the extended verb ending that Coverdale's using there, okay? And then you look over in the King James for verse 5, and it says, prepares the table before me, my cup runneth over, those extended verb endings. When the King James is retaining a lot of those extended verb endings, they actually were used in the English language way before the King James translators ever did their work. And the King James, in many cases, is retaining that structure, that verb structure, even though it had already fallen out of common use by the time the 1611 Bible is translated. And we know that because if we go back to Coverdale or we go back to Tyndale, we see them using the extended verb ending nearly 300 years before the King James translators did their work. And then last we have verse 6, Psalm 23, verse 6. Coverdale said, Oh, let thy loving kindness and mercy follow me all the days of my life, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord forever. King James, Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So structurally, you see that. So let's go to the point there under the 23rd Psalm. The King James is clearly an improvement over Coverdale in terms of rhythmic flow and poetic style. That said, Coverdale's rendering served as the draft, as the rough draft, for these psalms, as well as many other portions of the poetic books found in the Old Testament. Recall that Tyndale was not able to translate the poetic books before his execution. So if we're assessing Coverdale's ability as a translator, it is to the wisdom literature, to the poetic literature, and the prophets that we most need to turn our attention. Now we have an interesting example from Gerald Hammond on Ecclesiastes. Next point, bottom of page 4. Gerald Hammond offers a balanced analysis of Coverdale's work in Ecclesiastes and Proverbs in his Making of the English Bible. Consider the following comparison between Coverdale's rendering of Ecclesiastes 5, 10 through 12 with that of the King James. So Ecclesiastes 5, 10, Coverdale. He that loveth money will never be satisfied with money, and whoso delighteth in riches shall have no profit thereof. Is not this a vain thing? King James for Ecclesiastes 5:10. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. Way more rhythm, way more flow in the King James, but Coverdale is sort of an initial attempt at capturing that. Verse 11, Coverdale says, Whereas many riches are, there are many also that spend them, and what pleasure more hath he that possesseth them, saving he may look upon them with his eyes. Very wordy from Coverdale there. King James, When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? So then you can look at verse 12. I want to move on to the analysis. After comparing the two passages, Hammond makes the following evaluative comment. So he's evaluating the work of Coverdale here, and he says, quote, The Authorized Version translators are closer to the strictly literal meaning and syntax of the Hebrew, but their version is wooden and unconvincing when set beside Coverdale's. When they want to round verses off with a final rhythmic close, they follow Coverdale word for word. To take one example of Coverdale's superiority in verse 11, saving, quote, saving the beholding of them with their eyes is the Authorized Version's rendering of a fairly compressed Hebrew clause, meaning literally, but only seeing his eyes. The verb is a participle, hence the King James Version's beholding. Coverdale changes the grammar a little and produces an effective and scarcely less compressed rendering with none of the unnecessary impersonality of the Authorized Version's equivalent. So here's the thing again. Coverdale's doing a good job, but which one is literally following, strictly literally following the meaning and syntax of the Hebrew? Again, it's not Coverdale. Coverdale's making some stylistic contributions in English that the King James is going to utilize, but the one that is more closely aligned to the literal meaning and syntax of the Hebrew is not Coverdale, it's King James. Now, why would that be? Well, the reason that would be is because Coverdale wasn't proficient in Hebrew. So on to the next point. Recall from lesson 114 that Coverdale was not proficient in Hebrew. That's what I just said. Therefore, the translational decisions of Coverdale, noted by Hammond, are not due to Coverdale's intimate knowledge of Hebrew, but rather what he had before him in his five sundry translations upon which he based his work. My reason for quoting Hammond on this point is to highlight that as a translator, Coverdale worked more off of rhythmic feel in English than Hebrew syntax. Consequently, Coverdale's work lacks the accuracy that is found in Tyndale and the King James. Hammond elaborates on this point as follows. So quoting Hammond, excuse me, bottom of page 5, top of page 6 here. In the book of Proverbs, Coverdale's rendering sometimes seemed quaint or expansive in verses familiar to us from the Authorized Version, but not always without effect. Consider two fairly recognizable examples. Presumptuousness goeth before destruction, and after a proud stomach followeth a fall. Now that's Coverdale, right? So I'm going to look that up just quickly in King James. So I'm finding here Proverbs 16, verse 18. King James says, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Coverdale said in this instance, presumptuousness goeth before destruction, and after a proud stomach, there followeth a fall. And another one, another example is, an undiscreet son is the heaviness of his father, and a brawling wife is like the top of a house where through it is ever dropping. So you're like, huh, what's that? Come over to Proverbs 19, let's look at verse 13 in the King James quick. Here it says, a foolish son is the calamity of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dropping. So there's some differences there. But equally often, Coverdale's rendering is striking, either because it is recognizably the source, sometimes word for word, of the Authorized Version's rendering, or because it presents us with an equally attractive alternative, if not a more attractive one. In chapter 23, for instance, he begins by missing the point entirely, where the Authorized Version warns about sitting down to eat with the ruler, quote, put a knife to thy throat if thou be a man given to appetite. Coverdale merely has measure them appetite. But in verses 5 through 7, he achieves a persuasively flexible warning against the desire for riches and earth. I think that should say riches on earth with the envious. Less accurate, more memorable than the Authorized Version's rendering of these verses. Verse 5, he says, why wilt thou set thine eye upon ye thing which suddenly vanisheth away? For riches make them, some of this I can't even make out, something wages, or wings possibly even, and take flight of an angel to in that ye err. So, sometimes Coverdale is almost gibberish when it's read by a modern reader because he's not really capturing in English well what's going on. So let's just look at that verse. This is, what is this here? This is Proverbs 23. Go to Proverbs 23 and let's look at verse 5. Go to Proverbs 23 and let's look at verse 5. Now this is what the King James says. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Much more discernible than what Coverdale had. Moving on. Later in the chapter, verse 13 goes directly into the Authorized Version, with only the dropping of thereof from the end. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die thereof. So let's look at verse 13. See the King James. It says, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. So the only difference in that verse between Coverdale and King James is the dropping of the thereof from the end of the verse. In verses 20 through 22, the most distinctive words of the Authorized Version's translation come directly from Coverdale. Verse 20, keep no company with wine beggars, debtors, and riotous eaters of flesh, for such be drunkards and riotous shall not something, and he that is a glutton shall not sleep. Let's read this in the King James. Very, very hard to discern things there. Look at verse 21. For the drunkard and the glutton shall shall come to poverty, and the drowsiness shall come to a man with rags. So again, Coverdale is hard to discern in some of these places. And then in the memorable description of the whore in verse 27 and 28, Coverdale goes one better by giving a physical point to the comparison of her in a ditch and a pit. In fact, he compares her to a grave and a pit. Quote, for a whore is a deep grave and an harlot is a narrow pit. And builds on this in the next verse, she lurketh like a thief, and those that be not aware she bringeth unto her. It ought to be said, though, that the Authorized Versions, finish to this verse, which has none of Coverdale's physicality, and increaseth the transgressors among men, is more truer to the Hebrew. So again, the point here is this. Coverdale is not proficient in Hebrew, so while he is very good as far as his English sense and awareness and how he's able to take the five interpreters, he's not necessarily able to deal very clearly with the syntax of the Hebrew. So the King James is more accurate, even though in some cases Coverdale is setting up a base, if you will, for the King James to operate on. Bottom of page 6, Hammond concludes his discussion of Coverdale's handling of Hebrew poetry with the following cautionary statement, quote, I ought not go too far in praising Coverdale. By selective quotation, it can be possible to make him appear the most expressive of the English Bible translators, and that would be a mistake. The pieces I have quoted here have been long enough to show his achievements are not solitary flashes of inspiration. Just as often, however, his lack of knowledge of the original makes his translations come close to gibberish, end quote. So we see that there. Sometimes Coverdale is great. Sometimes he's hardly even discernible in the way that he's rendering things in English. After comment upon Coverdale's poetic work, Blackford Condit goes on to discuss his work on the prophets. So remember I said earlier in the lesson that if you want to understand the originality of Coverdale as a translator, you need to look at the poetic books, the wisdom literature, as well as the prophets. Condit says the following, the same rhythmic flow so noticeable in Coverdale's translation of the Psalms is found likewise in his translation of the prophetical books. Given the difference in the style of literature between the poetic books and the prophets, Condit views Coverdale's style as, quote, more stately and elevated in the prophets. So a form of literature is quite different between the prophetic books and the poetry that's found in the poetic books. Condon thinks that Coverdale is much more stately and so forth and elevated in the prophets than he is in the poetic books. He then goes on to cite Isaiah 40 as an example. Please note that I've updated Coverdale's spelling for ease of reading. So again, I've given you Isaiah 40 here, verse 1 all the way down through verse 11 in the notes. So that starts on page 7 and concludes at the top of page 8. So let's just look at maybe 4 of these as examples. And we should have time to do that, I think. Let me just peek ahead here. Yeah, we'll look at 3 or 4 examples here. So top of page 7, Isaiah 40, verse 1, Coverdale says, "Be of good cheer, my people, be of good cheer, saith your God." King James, comfort ye my people, saith your God. So, different wording, structurally very similar in that case. Verse 2, Coverdale, "Comfort Jerusalem and tell her that her travail is at an end, that her offense is pardoned, that she hath received of the Lord's hand sufficient correction for all her sins." That's Coverdale. Same verse, King James. "Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins." So again, there's definitely some differences there that would potentially be significant. Verse 3, "A voice crieth, prepare ye the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make straight ye path for your God in the desert." So that's Coverdale. King James, very famous verse applied in the New Testament to John the Baptist. "The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for your God." So we see there again significance in the Coverdale is providing in many ways a base for King James later on to build off of in these examples here. Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to read the rest of all these to you. I commend the rest of this table to you for your own study and your own consideration as you're processing what I'm saying and sort of looking for a verification or evidence of it. That's why I gave you so many examples here. So let's go to the top of page 8 then. First bullet point on the top of page 8. Condon also includes examples from Isaiah 41 and 43, which I have elected not to reproduce here in the interest of time and space. After citing these examples from Coverdale, Condon states, quote, "The above examples are Coverdale translating in which he was independent of Tyndale." And again, that's why this is so important. If you want to see his skill, if you want to assess his skill, if you want to evaluate how Coverdale was as a translator, we need to go to those portions of his work where he was independent of Tyndale, where there had been nothing done in English prior for him to look at or revise. Again, Gerald Hammond provides the most detailed analysis of Coverdale's skills as an original translator by breaking down his work in the prophets. Consider the following breakdown of Coverdale's work in Micah from the pen of Hammond. So this quote from Hammond here is quite long, but it looks at some things here related to how Coverdale handled the book of Micah. So let's begin that quote there. "Take the book of Micah as an example. Its first chapter clearly fails to impress a pattern on Coverdale. He knows that he is translating the words of a vehement prophet, and he attempted to convey the vehemence in his favorite way by interpolating words and phrases like yea and for why. But the result is a mess close to incoherence." These are verses 5 through 13. Then I have a bracket here. Please note that I have updated the spelling. So verses 1 through 4 are nearly incomprehensible. They're merely incoherent in Coverdale. Starting at verse 5, though, is what I'll give you. So it might be good if you would just turn quick in your Bible to Micah. Turn your Bible to Micah chapter 1. And you can kind of follow along with this if you want to in your King James Bible as I go through some of these verses in Coverdale. So let's look at verse 5. Micah chapter 1, verse 5. Here's what Coverdale says. He says, "And all this shall be for the wickedness of Jacob and the sins of the house of Israel. But what is the wickedness of Jacob? Is it not Samaria, which are the high places of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem?" The King James says in verse 5, "For the transgression of Jacob is all this, and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem?" So you can see there's a lot of very good translation that's done there from Coverdale in verse 5, where verses 1 through 4 in the same chapter are nearly incoherent as far as your ability to read them in English. Verse 6, Coverdale. "Therefore I shall make Samaria a heap of stones in the field to lay about the vineyard. Her stones shall I cast into the valley and discover her foundations." King James in verse 6. "Therefore I will make Samaria as a heap of the field and as plantings of a vineyard, and I will pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I will discover the foundations thereof." So the point is, Coverdale can vary widely, even within a chapter, within a passage, within a book. His renderings are very mixed depending on where you're looking in his Bible. So again, I'm going to commend to you here verse 7 through 13 in the notes to read and compare on your own time, and then I want to go to the analysis there at the bottom of page 8. The Hebrew is not as symmetrical here as it is in other parts of the prophetic books, and Coverdale's translation reflects the stumbling around of his predecessors. Only occasionally does the parallel structure of the Hebrew poetic line peep through, and when it does, it comes close to saving Coverdale's version. It is especially so in his rendering of part of verse 7. They are gathered out of the hire of an whore, and into the whore's hire shall they be turned again. Here Coverdale has reproduced exactly the pattern of the Hebrew. The contrast of antithetical verbs, gather and return, with the virtually independent noun phrases, the hire of a whore and whore's hire, and a powerful rhythmic effect is helped by the chiastic word order, where the verb followed by its object is mirrored in the second half by the verb preceded by its object. But if you compare the way the same passage emerges from the hands of translators who have grasped the patterning of the original, then it is the authorized version's rendering, then the contrast makes this look primitive, lacking both a clear idea of what the prophecy means or any rhythmic control to convey its meaning. So again, what he's saying there is that the King James rendering is superior because they understand the Hebrew structure, syntax, word order, and the parallelisms that are happening in the Hebrew poetry. So we could go on here with this. So you're on top of page 9 in the notes. Scroll down to, it said, one of the last points there, comparing the authorized version. You can see the comparison there, verses 1 and 2 in Coverdale with the authorized version. It says the authorized version's rendering is more accurate, but it succeeds no better in conveying the Hebrew parallelism, and its most distinctive phrases trace back to Coverdale. So there's a lot to consider here, way more than I've had time to work into these notes. So let's go to that next point for the sake of time. Interested parties are encouraged to obtain a copy of Hammond's work to read the rest of his comments about Coverdale's rendering of the prophets. There's a ton of detail there, way more than we have time to get into. What I've tried to do here is give you sort of the bird's eye view of what's going on with Coverdale. In the interest of brevity, suffice it to say that Coverdale's original translations are a mixed bag. So here's the point. They're a mixed bag of clarity and rhythmic cadence with incoherence that is hardly readable in English. So sometimes Coverdale's brilliant. Other times you can hardly discern what he's saying. So the bottom of page 9, there are some examples here. To illustrate this point, consider the following memorable and idiomatic original renderings of Coverdale from the poetic and prophetic books. So look there. I've given you the King James and I've given you Coverdale. Coverdale's the top line and King James is the indented line. So from the law, Exodus 20, verse 14, Coverdale said, "Thou shalt not break wedlock." King James says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." So obviously, if you're married and you're in a wedlock and you have an affair, you're breaking the wedlock, you're committing adultery. But it's a idiomatic rendering here, the way Coverdale has it when he says, "Thou shalt not break wedlock," which is an interesting case in that he varied from Tyndall in this point. Another example is Job 19, verse 18, where Coverdale said, "Ye, the very desert fools despise me." King James says, "Yea, young children despise me. So what exactly are desert fools? It's not real clear. So again, example of where Coverdale is very hard to follow or understand. Another interesting one is Psalm 90, verse 10. Coverdale had, "The days of our age are 70. King James, "The days of our years are 70 years and 10. So the days of our age is a little bit confusing. What exactly does that mean? Whereas the days of our years, so in other words, generally how long does a human live is kind of what the psalmist is getting after there, right? So 70 and 10 would be what? It's about 70. A score is 20. 70 would be 60. 10 would be 70. 70 years. Whereas the days of our age are 70 and 10. What does that mean? It's just confusing the way Coverdale has that in that verse. Another example there at the top page 10 is Proverbs 16, verse 28. He that is a blabble of his tongue maketh division. He that is a blabble of his tongue maketh division. King James has, and a whisperer separateth chief friends. So way more clarity there than what Coverdale had in Proverbs 16:28. And then the last example that I'll give is Jeremiah 17, verse 1. So notice here that except the one there from Exodus 20 where we were talking about breaking wedlock, the rest of these examples are coming from Job, from Psalms, from Proverbs, from the wisdom literature, and then the last one is from Jeremiah, the prophets. So Coverdale had in Jeremiah 17:1, he had, "Your sin, O ye of the tribe of Judah, is written in the table of your hearts, engraven so upon the edges of your altars with a pen of iron and with an adamant claw." Okay? King James, "The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with the point of a diamond is it graved upon the table of their heart and upon the horns of your altars." So what is this, the idea of an adamant claw and so forth, very confusing there, what Coverdale is driving at. King James offers definitely much more clarity with its rendering the point of a diamond and the ability of the point of the diamond to obviously write, you know, engrave something on a table, right? So the understanding of what the verse is trying to convey is much more clear in the way the King James has that than what Coverdale did. Okay, so from this lesson, it would appear safe to conclude that in those areas where Coverdale's work was unique to himself, i.e., previous groundwork laid by Tyndall was not available to draw upon, Coverdale is a bit of a mixed bag. His translations range from sound and endearing, as in the Psalms, to almost nonsensical and incoherent in other sections of the poets and the prophets. In lesson 116, so that'll be what we're going to do next week, in lesson 116, we will consider further, we will consider the second feature, I think that should say, of Coverdale's work, and we will consider Coverdale as a reviser of Tyndale. So in this lesson, we've been focusing mostly on ascertaining his ability as a translator, but looking at those sections for which his work stands alone, in that there was no previous printed editions or anything for him to draw on in English. Next time, what we're going to be looking at is trying to ascertain how he revised Tyndale and what his work was like as a reviser of Tyndale. And then, so that'll be lesson 116, and then in lesson 117, we're going to talk about the contents of the Coverdale Bible with a particular emphasis on looking at how he handled the Apocrypha in the first completed English Bible, and then how that set a precedent for how the Apocrypha would be handled in Protestant editions of the Bible from that point forward. So we definitely have a few more interesting things to consider regarding Coverdale. I hope that you're finding this interesting and beneficial. I appreciate those of you that have turned in to watch this particular lesson. I'm going to sign off now, end this lesson, and then I'll be back on live at about 10:30 with the main Sunday morning message of Grace Life Bible Church for this Sunday, May 3rd. So thanks for your attention. Appreciate it.